Clarinet.com. Let us help you see clearly. Clear tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, highs 62 to 66, breezy south winds.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Sending them back where they've never been. The Trump administration deports another group of people to the tiny African kingdom of Eswatini. A lawyer representing two of the men, one originally from Yemen, the other from Cuba, tells us their families had no idea where they'd gone.
And sticking to no guns, James Bond fans react in shock and horror when a streaming service photoshops 007's pistol out of ads for the movies, suggesting it's revoking his license to kill.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll also hear the set list in just a few moments, but right now let's sample our album of the week, Cut and Rewind by Say She She. It is this trio's third album, and sonically they draw from soul, disco, and funk of the 70s through three-part harmonies. You can read more about it at KAXE.org. Let us know your thoughts as well. Text 218-326-1234. The song we'll hear this evening from Say She She is called Bandit.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at three shows this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, October 9th through the 11th, in Gilbert, Bemidji, and Grand Rapids, plus a festival all next week in Duluth. First up, award-winning blues guitarist PK Mayo is playing the Ore House in Gilbert Thursday at 6 p.m., Born in Eveleth, the Iron Reins musician is a member of the Minnesota Blues Hall of Fame and has released albums under PK Mayo and his full name, Paul Mayasich. His live repertoire includes his original tunes and a wide variety of folk, blues, rock, and country tunes. PK Mayo at the Ore House this Thursday. On Friday, Christopher David Hansen is playing solo at Bridget's Irish Pub in Bemidji at 7:30. A roots rock and Americana singer-songwriter, Hansen's most recent album was Whippoorwill in 2022, and he recently formed a new group called Bewilderness with his son Cameron on drums. It's Christopher David Hansen this Friday at Bridget's in Bemidji. On to Saturday, Tattletale, Forge North, and Mary and Emily LaPlante are playing a benefit show at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 p.m. Headliners and host Tattletale are a psychedelic jazz fusion group who draw from Ethiopian jazz and other global funk sounds. Forge North are an Americana and jam band from Longville led by soulful songwriter Charlie Wagner. And Mary and Emily LaPlante are a talented mother-daughter bluegrass and folk duo. This Saturday in Grand Rapids at Rapids Brewing. And finally, a quick shout out to WUSO's 1 Week Live, taking place all next week, the 13th through the 18th in Duluth. Multiple bands perform each night, and the recordings will later be released as an album. The long-running series is one of the best documents of northeastern Minnesota music for over 20 years now. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Can't spell politics without I. The French government is in chaos yet again after the country's latest prime minister resigns abruptly. Even veteran political experts are not sure what will come next. But our guest says one thing is clear. Ego issues are to blame.
The sky is falling. A human rights watcher tells us about a devastating aerial attack on a candlelit gathering in Myanmar and what the military government's air power suggests about the trajectory of the civil war.
Fighting flight response. They're not from Eswatini and had never been to Eswatini. But tonight, I'll speak with a lawyer representing two men who were sent to the tiny kingdom of Eswatini, where they're being held in a maximum security prison.
Up to her old treks. When students at a high school in Maine get detention, they can sit in a classroom or they can go for a hike. The teacher who started the program says it helps students to walk a mile in their shoes.
Ironically, every other beaver pales in comparison. An Ontario photographer tells us the magical tale of his encounters with an incredibly rare beaver whose existence was foretold in the Canadian prophecies. A beaver that is entirely white.
And perfectly armless, James Bond fans are badly shaken and stirred to action when a streaming service puts up photos of their hero's movies in which his trademark pistol has been photoshopped out. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that enters the arms erase. It is a stereotype that the French are prone to be dramatic, and whether that's generally true or not, France's dramatic tendencies are definitely on full display right now in the total chaos that's unfolding in front of the world. In a surprise move, Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu resigned on Monday, less than a month into the role. He's the third prime minister to leave office in less than a year. On President Emmanuel Macron's orders, Mr. Lecornu just spent 48 hours negotiating with other political parties to bring some stability to the government. To give you an idea of how that went, he told the public TV network France 2 tonight that his mission is over. Not accomplished. This all follows months of political impasse in the splintered National Assembly, where leaders can't agree on anything. And to make matters worse, calls for President Macron to resign are getting louder once again. Olivier Costa is a professor at the Center for Political Research of Sciences Po University in Paris. We reached him in Bordeaux, France.
Professor, as you know, the outgoing prime minister has been speaking on French television after trying to get people together, you know, speaking to leaders in the National Assembly, trying to solve things. It didn't work. He says they could be solved. But from where you sit, is the French government on the brink of collapse right now?
It's very difficult to say, and I'm really confused by the situation because it's totally unique in the history of the last, let's say, 70 years, that situation of deep fragmentation of the National Assembly and absence of a majority. So the prime minister has spoken on TV this evening, but he was very efficient in saying basically nothing in 20 minutes of time. And so I still don't know what the plans are. This is extremely vague.
There's a lot of, as you say, very vague. There are a lot of maybes, might-bes. We'll see what happens. In that television interview, the prime minister said that he believes the problem is that France is missing a, quote, willingness to create compromise in parliament, unquote. Do you think that's what the problem is?
Oh, yeah, totally. We have a problem because the French political regime is a very bizarre one. It's a kind of a mix between the US and the Canadian parliamentary system. So we have a president who's directly elected. He has quite some power. But still, the government depends very much on the existence of a majority in the parliament. But since last year, there is no more majority in the National Assembly, which is divided in three blocks: the left, the center, and the right, and the extreme right. And no one wants to cooperate with the other bloc because everyone is just thinking about the next presidential elections.
2027.
And the better, 2027 or earlier if Macron resigns. Mm. And the best way to win those elections is not to be in office. Then you can just sit in your couch and criticize everything which has been made and say that you have all the solution to fix that.
What are people across France saying? You know, when you have dinner with people who are out and about, or maybe in your classes or at the research center where you work, what are people saying about all of this?
There are two categories: those who understand a bit the situation and they can explain why it is like that. And I would say that most citizens in France, they don't understand the details of why those guys are not able to find a compromise. And this is just fueling anger and is fueling the vote for the extreme left and especially the extreme right. And I'm fearing that the vote for the extreme right will be massive in the next elections.
Macron, as you said, you know, resignation is a possibility. There are other prime ministers that served with him who are calling for his resignation as well. But do you think that is likely?
Macron is not the kind of guy to resign. He has a quite peculiar personality, and all the French president had ego issues. And so I'm not sure that Macron would resign. And also I'm not sure that it's a solution, because if the president resign, we'll go for presidential election. But that president, I'm not sure he will be able to find, or she will be able to find, a majority, because there is no majority now. So an option is to call for another dissolution. But it's likely that the fragmentation will remain.
How do you think this is going to end?
First solution would be for political leaders at some point to stop fighting like kids in the square. And the second solution is that we would go for new election.
Right.
And then it is likely that this will be a win for the extreme right. And then what is quite likely to happen in France is something like in Italy, having a very large number of seats in the parliament, maybe not a majority, but then convincing a certain number of people coming from the traditional right wing to work with them to govern the country.
If a new prime minister is named in the next 48 hours or before the end of this week, I mean, are there names, are there people who could do what the previous PMs have not been able to do in the last year?
I think it's not a matter of persons, because Sébastien Lecornu, the one who tried, I think he really tried hard. He discussed with everyone. So I think it's not a question of person. It's a question just of mindset of the leaders of the party, and that everyone would agree that we need a government, we need a budget. Otherwise, we're going to lose the confidence of our partner at European level, of financial markets. And so I see the solution is more about politicians to start fighting again for the next presidential election in 2027.
The French people are not known for being silent when they're upset about things. Do you think their response, if this drags on, if this upheaval continues, could sway what these leaders actually do?
There is a pressure, but I don't think and I don't expect to have massive mobilization because it does not have a meaning. You cannot ask reform if there is no minister to address.
And is there, I mean, of the issues, the budget, as you mentioned, also immigration, the retirement age reform that was controversial when it was adopted earlier this year, is there any way that someone giving or, you know, making a concession on any of those issues would settle things down?
I think so. And now we're entering a new age, the age of a parliamentary regime, where you need to make concession, but at the same time, you also need to be able to show that you have won something. And the whole discussion today about the budget, should we tax more or less the rich, or retirement age, or maybe immigration, is about the political leaders to be able to say, okay, I want to discuss that.
Olivier, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Olivier Costa is a political science professor with Sciences Po University in Paris. We reached him in Bordeaux, France. You remember the images of deportees sent to a super maximum security prison in El Salvador by the Trump administration months ago. There have been headlines since about deals struck between the U.S. and countries like South Sudan and Uganda to accept third country deportees, people with no connection to those countries. Well, on Monday, 10 people arrived in a new far-flung location, the tiny landlocked kingdom of Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland. It's wedged between South Africa and Mozambique. It's Africa's last remaining absolute monarchy. And this week's group is the second to arrive there after an initial group of five was sent to a maximum security prison in Eswatini in July. Alma David is the American attorney for two of the men, one originally from Yemen, the other from Cuba. We reached her in Montreal, where she's currently based.
Alma, have you been able to communicate with your clients at this point?
In a manner of speaking, I'm in contact with their families, and they're able to contact their families about once a week. And I have spoken to one of my clients a couple of times briefly by WhatsApp video call, but it's not a private conversation. It's a conversation where someone from the prison, like either the chief of the prison or one of the guards, is present right there in the room. Not an actual attorney-client kind of legal visit. And, you know, one of the big issues that we're having right now is that because we aren't able to have confidential conversations with them, we're not 100% sure how they're doing. So, we're really working on trying to get access for the local attorney who's there so that he can meet with them in person and talk to them about how they're doing and really what the conditions are like.
Do they have access to lawyers there on the ground?
We've been working with a lawyer in Eswatini, and he's been trying really hard to get access to the men and has been prevented from seeing them on multiple occasions in this kind of like Kafka-esque saga of lies and excuses for why he can't see them. And actually this past Friday, finally, the High Court of Eswatini granted him access, but the government immediately appealed that decision, so it stayed for now, and is now on appeal to the Supreme Court of Eswatini, and my understanding is that process can take several months, so in the meantime, they're without access to him.
What does that suggest to you?
I mean, generally, the fact that the government is appealing it should suggest to me that they don't want to have to answer for why these men are being detained. And I don't know if that's because the government of Eswatini has decided on their own that they don't want to have to answer for that, or that, you know, the U.S. and the government of Eswatini together have agreed that it would be better if the detention wasn't challenged. But it seems to me that that's what's going on.
The Assistant Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, as you likely know, Alma, has been posting on social media about these deportations, specifically in terms of your clients. She says that both of them were convicted of murder in the U.S., though, as you know, one was convicted of attempted murder. They had served their prison sentences, but what was their legal status before they were deported?
So they had both originally been legal permanent residents of the United States, and then they had both lost their status because of criminal convictions and had been ordered deported. And that was you know, in one case, like in the mid 90s, and in the other case, in 2019. And so since then, they were, you know, they were living in the community. They had these regular check-ins with ICE because they had an order of deportation that couldn't or wasn't being carried out. They had work permits pursuant to that, to the supervision order that they were reporting under with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They didn't have their residence anymore, but they were in the United States, you know, with ICE's permission. Basically, they were being given work authorization pursuant to this order of supervision that they were under with ICE.
The language that the Assistant Secretary has used, how do you respond to that?
They're playing on people's fears, right? They're trying to make it sound like everybody who's in the United States without authorization is dangerous or has committed a crime or is about to commit a crime. You know, that being said, it's true that my clients both have serious criminal convictions. And at the same time, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that has no bearing on whether or not they should be deported to Eswatini and then illegally detained. You know, as you said, they've served their sentences. They certainly haven't committed any crimes in Eswatini, and yet they're detained in a maximum security prison there. So there's a lot of things that just don't add up there.
Your clients are from Cuba and Yemen. Has there been any explanation so far about why they were sent to Eswatini?
No, absolutely not.
How did their families learn about what had happened?
Well, my Cuban client's family actually learned about it from a Cuban news channel online. I think it was online, because, you know, in that Twitter post that you referenced, mm-hmm. Trisha McLaughlin had sent out their photos. And so his photo was, you know, posted on like a Cuban news site, and they recognized him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'd been missing. Like, they were worried. They were wondering where he was because he just disappeared from immigration detention with no explanation. And then for the Yemeni family's man, they also didn't know where he was. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of able to piece it together, after realizing that he was missing and then, you know, finding his photo and figuring it out.
What is the best case scenario for your clients now as you see it? What do you think you'll be able to achieve on their behalf?
You know, I don't know what specifically I'll be able to achieve on their behalf. My hope is that they will eventually be somewhere where they can live safely and not in detention. Mm-hmm. You know, where that ends up being at this point is still unclear. In the short term, obviously, our goal is for the local attorney to have access to them so that we can actually have a private, personal, in-depth conversation with each of them and talk about what they want, because currently that's just not possible.
They didn't want to leave. They don't want to be in Eswatini, but do they want to go back to the United States?
They both have family ties, you know, strong family ties and community ties in the United States, and they don't really have those anywhere else. So I imagine in a world where there wasn't such extreme hostility against them in the United States, they would rather be in the U.S. with their family and mm-hmm. friends and loved ones. But again, I can't really say much about what they want because I haven't been able to ascertain that.
Alma, thank you for this.
Oh, thank you.
Alma David is an attorney based in Montreal. We reached her there. Ahab had his white whale, and now Dennis Jackson has his white beaver. The only difference is the beaver is smaller. The other only difference is that, unlike Ahab, Mr. Jackson has not been driven mad by a thirst for revenge. Also, Ahab's white whale variously symbolizes doom, the ocean, fate, and nature, but Dennis Jackson's white beaver just represents a beaver that is white. The Ottawa photographer spotted the rare creature on a fishing trip near Perth, Ontario. And the pale beaver is not shy. Mr. Jackson has seen it a few times now. We reached Dennis Jackson in Ottawa.
And Dennis, you were out fishing something you do from time to time, and then you saw something that you don't see very often. You hadn't until that point. What happened?
Well, yeah, it's actually kind of interesting. I was out fishing with my neighbor, Gerald, and we were in a spot that we get to sometimes, and I was looking around, and across the bay, I could see something white in the water. And I looked at Gerald, and I said, Gerald, what is that that we see over there? And he's like, I'm not sure. So we started to move the boat towards this white thing that we saw, and I couldn't tell like really what it was, and I'm thinking to myself, well, it's not a swan, it's too small, and it doesn't look like the crest of a loon, and I don't think it's a seagull, and we kept getting closer and closer, and finally it dipped under the water, and I said to Gerald, I said, I think it might be a beaver, and he said, a beaver? Nah, that thing was white. And all of a sudden, I look down, and it swam underneath the boat. And I'm in complete disbelief. This massive white beaver comes underneath the boat. We're both looking at each other. I could feel the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And it came out in front of us. I did not have any of my photography equipment.
No. Oh, my goodness.
So we're scrambling to pull out our cell phones as this beaver is kind of swimming away from us. And it swam away, and we're taking some footage, and we're looking at each other and giving each other a massive high five, like, what did we just witness? And we stood there trying to make sense of everything we just saw, because in no world did I ever think that we would ever see a white beaver when we were out fishing.
There was never a legend of a white beaver in those waters. I mean, there's a white squirrel, infamous in Toronto, but never before had you heard.
I've never even heard of a white beaver, so I would never even think to see one.
And what have you learned about them and just how rare it is?
I haven't learned a whole lot. when we saw the beaver and I looked up, you know, as best I could, previous sightings, I found that there was one, I think it was in 2020 in New Brunswick. Anyways, after that, I went out the next night with another photographer friend of mine, Joe Wilson, and we sat in the same spot, and we didn't see it, and we moved around a little bit and sat in another quieter part, and all of a sudden, the white beaver came out. We were fully geared up with our cameras, and we just started taking pictures and video, and it was just remarkable as it swam all around the waters in front of us.
Or maybe it was performing for you. It's like, finally, I'm discovered. I was waiting.
And so what transpired from there is we engaged with Michael Runz, who's a very well-known naturalist and biologist. And I was able to take Michael and his wife out on a different evening to try and help us make sense of what we were seeing. And he was struggling with, you know, is it albinism or is it leucism? Mm-hmm. And came to his determination that it's actually leucitic. It's a leucitic beaver, which means it doesn't have all of the pigments, I guess, of an albino beaver.
Mm-hmm. In terms of its behavior as it was swimming around, did it have any other unusual characteristics in how it was swimming and behaving compared to beavers that you would normally see?
It didn't do anything that any other beaver wouldn't do. Yeah. It seemed to be behaving normally and like a regular beaver that's swimming around and looking for food sources, or I'm presuming, and I'm, you know, we didn't notice any behavior that would make us go, oh, that's different.
Did your friend and his wife tell you how rare it actually is?
I don't think he could quantify it, mm-hmm. But he said that in his lifetime, he's never seen, this was the largest white mammal that he had ever seen. Mm-hmm. And that's how he put it.
And it's so remarkable that you did get that second chance, not just to get the pictures, but to experience it, right? I mean, it could have just been that one opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we were fortunate to kind of figure out roughly where it was located, and be able to go back again and be able to experience that with Michael. And so we were able to get photographs and Michael was able to make some kind of determination around its, it being Lucidic. So from that, he was saying that to us that it was incredibly rare, and mm-hmm. and just being able to witness such an occurrence was, we were very, very, very fortunate.
It's a special couple of days on the water, certainly. You've been really careful about not telling people where you saw this white beaver. What are you worried might happen if the location did get out?
I think that it's important to preserve wildlife in its natural state. And as a photographer, I've seen when there are sightings of owls, for example, where you'll all of a sudden find 20 or 30 or 40 people will show up. And for me anyways, it's important in a circumstance like this to make sure that the natural habitat is preserved and that the beavers can go on just living their normal and natural lives.
Well, Dennis, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much, Neil.
We reached photographer Dennis Jackson in Ottawa. Stop. I'm sorry. We accidentally played the original James Bond opening. That's the one where you're looking down the barrel of a gun and James Bond walks in with a gun and he shoots his gun. It was the wrong file. Could you play James Bond Final .mp3 instead? Yeah. You see, that was way less stressful. And you can't see it, but instead of a gun barrel, we were looking down a water slide. Look, I hate to tell you this if you're a James Bond purist, but your suave, gun-toting hero has changed. He's changed in the present, and he has been changed in the past. And he might never have been the same again. Recently, Amazon Prime Video in the UK made some tweaks to the artwork for James Bond movies. And at first glance, you might not notice. But then you realize, A, none of the Bonds pictured, Connery, Moore, Brosnan, or Craig, is holding 007's famous firearm, the Walther PPK. And B, that's weird because A, they were holding it in the original photos, and B, they just photoshopped the guns out. So Connery and Brosnan's hands are still curled like, they're holding invisible guns. But Bond fans were very upset by this. And after the ensuing kerfuffle, Prime Video UK replaced all those photos with stills from the movies in which the Bonds are also not holding guns. So the intent is clear. But, what's next? Will they change the name of that one character in Goldfinger to Cats Aplenty? Will they turn a classic Bondism like this?
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Into something uncool like this?
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink.
Mountain Dew Baja Blast.
Shaken, not stirred.
Well, so far, no. They're just changing the gun photos, even though the guy has a signature gun, and we all know what it is. But I guess when it comes to the Walther PPK, Amazon executives are totally over a barrel. Here's Grizzly Bear with Gunshy. Grizzly Bear with Gunshy.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, after receiving eye surgery for a rare type of night vision loss, a BC teenager sees a meteor shower for the first time.
And walking wonders. A teacher in Maine is turning detention on its head by putting students on their feet and taking them out for a hike. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Alyssa Ellen, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And more great music continues at 10 on Headwaters with Kari Hedlund. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. And we thank Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Clear skies tonight, lows 37 to 44, and increasing clouds tomorrow, high 62 to 66, south winds up to 15 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night, 44 to 50, and Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 60s. There's more ahead from As It Happens.
It was a peaceful candlelit gathering, in part to mark the Dindyut, a full moon festival held at the end of the Buddhist Sabbath, and in part to protest conscription by Myanmar's military government and an upcoming election that's perceived to be a sham. Then an army paraglider flew over the crowd and dropped two bombs. 24 people were killed, including children. Dozens more were wounded. It's one of many attacks on civilians carried out by the country's military government since the 2021 coup, but it was especially brazen and lethal, and it points to a crisis Myanmar watchers around the world say is only escalating. Shayna Bochner is a former resident of Myanmar and a researcher with the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. We reached her in New York City.
Shayna, there have been attacks on civilians in Myanmar in the past, certainly, but this particular attack and how it was carried out, what are you hearing from your contacts there?
So we're hearing what appeared to be a paramotor attack that happened. The reports we're getting is that multiple paramotors, which are these motorized paragliders, took off from the nearby military compound and dropped munitions on a candlelight gathering with about 100 to 200 people.
That kind of a tactic is quite striking. Why is that kind of tactic being employed now?
So this tactic is something that's come to be very common from the Myanmar military, particularly over the past few years as the opposition to the military has gained in strength and territory. We've seen more of these attacks, particularly aerial attacks that are either targeting civilians or are launched on civilian areas indiscriminately without any regard for the harm caused.
As our listeners heard just a moment ago, this was not just a political protest. It was also a full moon festival celebration. There were children, their families there. Would they have had any warning or reason to anticipate that there might be an attack like this?
They certainly shouldn't have. As you said, it was a festival gathering that was taking place as well as a protest. We know that of those who were killed, there were at least three children and other villagers and civilians who should not have to fear for their lives when taking place in any sort of gathering. But the military is increasingly targeting these types of civilian locations, schools, religious buildings, markets. There are systems that civilians and the opposition have themselves put in place to share warnings about a potential incoming attack. But like we saw in this case, they may get that less than 10 minutes before something happens. And when we talk to people from Myanmar, they are living in increasing fear.
In terms of the timing of this, and as you say, things have been escalating, these kinds of attacks are becoming more and more common. What should that tell our listeners about the broader status of what has happened since the coup in 2021?
I think it's a real demonstration of the impunity that the military carries out these crimes with. The abuses that it has carried out since the coup amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. These are grave atrocities that violate international law, and yet we've seen it faced almost no consequences. And even over the past few months, we've seen increasing support from certain actors, including China and Russia, which both provide arms and military equipment and political support to the Myanmar junta. Mm. And they also act as something of its defenders in international fora, and block stronger action on the military's crimes.
What is in it for China and Russia?
I would say it's certainly a mutually beneficial dynamic, particularly for China, which shares a long border with Myanmar and benefits hugely from Myanmar's natural resources. Chinese-linked companies are operating in rare earth mines all along the China-Myanmar border. And not only does it benefit from these resources, but it's able to exploit them under this completely unregulated and corrupt system that's arisen since the coup.
You were in Thailand recently speaking with people who have been displaced by this conflict. What were they telling you about the impact that the fighting has had, even for those who were able to get out?
So people who have fled Myanmar talk about living every day with a sense of fear of airstrikes, fear of ground attacks, fear of being displaced. Many people who I talked to have been displaced multiple times. The military has also carried out airstrikes on displacement camps. So even finding shelter in a new location doesn't guarantee safety. The military uses anti-personnel landmines, which is a banned weapon. So even walking around a village poses risk to civilians. This is why we've seen millions of people fleeing Myanmar since the coup, because of how many risks and threats they face on a daily basis there.
You know that there are other crises around the world that countries such as Canada are looking at, and some argue not doing enough about. But in terms of what is happening in Myanmar and what has happened most recently, what would you want to see from the international community?
There's certainly more that can be done in terms of expanding and strengthening international sanctions that have been imposed. Canada and other governments have put sanctions in place since the coup, but they have not been enforced cohesively or strongly enough. And these are really crucial for cutting the junta off from the arms that it uses to carry out these crimes and the revenue that is funding these atrocities. One of those paths should be implementing a total ban on the sale of aviation fuel to the junta, which would be a key step in reducing the tally of airstrikes.
Shayna, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Shayna Bauchner is a researcher with the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. We reached her in New York City. It turned out well in the end, but it might not have if it hadn't been for a dog named Eeyore. The Oskaloosa County Sheriff's Office in Florida has released body cam footage of the rescue of an elderly woman. She had set out in the evening for a short walk with Eeyore, and the recording tells the rest of the story. It begins with the 86-year-old's concerned husband speaking with a deputy.
She never takes more than 10 or 15 minutes. It's almost an hour now. It's over an hour now.
Okay, do you know what breed the dog is?
The dog's just a 100-pound dog.
Okay. There's the dog. Hi, baby. Where's your mama? Hi. Hey, where's your mama? Where's your mommy? Hold on, where's your mama? Show me where your mama is. Show me. I've got you, ma'am. 322, I've located her. She's laying here on the sidewalk, alert and conscious, but she may have injured herself. He ran up to my car and I said, bring me to your mommy, and she ran back here.
He came up to your car?
Mm-hmm. Good boy.
Oh, sweetheart.
Good boy. Very good boy.
I'm not even his owner. I'm his grandmother.
Oh, you're such a good boy. You're so good. You're so good.
Oh, Eeyore, you're a good boy. Grandma loves you.
Good boy, Eeyore.
That was Eeyore at the end there, an extremely good boy in Oskaloosa County, Florida, who looks like a golden lab with a touch of Lassie. That was our sound of the day. Promise you won't tell anyone this, but in high school, I got detention for making puns at the back of the classroom. And back then, for detention, you had to go to the library on a Saturday and sit there with a nerd, an athlete, a popular girl, an introvert, and a mean, cool guy until you learned life lessons from each other. But at one high school in Maine, students who received detention are being told to take a hike, literally. Leslie Trundy is a school counselor at Morse High School. She started a program that gets students outdoors as a form of connecting with nature and themselves, bringing a whole new meaning to "you're grounded." We reached Ms. Trundy in Bath, Maine.
Leslie, what was it that you saw in the old detention rooms that made you think we need to get these students out of here and that hiking would actually be better for them?
Yeah, I would say that I definitely had a sense that for some students, 6 hours in the building during the school day is a plenty of time, and that having that additional time after school sometimes was a challenge for kids. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing that got me thinking about bringing them outdoors was this idea that it would give them another opportunity to reflect on what had happened, maybe why they had landed in detention, but it would allow them to do that in a space that could sort of free their thoughts to think about maybe a different approach the next time they were faced with similar circumstances.
Yeah, because people, I'm sure you've heard people point out that it's supposed to be punishment. It's not supposed to be comfortable. So if they're bored inside a classroom, so be it. That's what punishment is like. But you're saying it's not actually effective. It's not about making it easier for them by being outside.
Yeah, I feel like walking gives the opportunity to loosen things up a little. And also there's a real power in being outdoors for our well-being. I think the physical movement sometimes can feel like a little bit of a punishment for kids who aren't super active, mm-hmm. even if they were enticed to come on the hike because it was a lessened sentence, because typically students spend 3 hours up to 3 hours in an indoor detention. And I'm offering them a 2 hour typically 2 hour hike, unless we're really fast. Mm-hmm. We might finish a smidge earlier. But for some kids, even if they elect in, walking for that long and the terrain is varied, there's some up and downs, we've hit some mud and ice and snow, that can feel challenging for some kids.
And what about the, you know, for those who getting any kind of detention or punishment, there's embarrassment associated with it for them, or even some, you know, depending on their families or how they grew up, shame even for getting that kind of punishment. Does this program help in that way?
it's really funny sometimes to listen to kids talk to each other about what happened and then get the perspective of the other student who maybe isn't their friend, but the other student might say like, yeah, you should have gotten in trouble for that. For that. So it's really been funny how the topic of what did you do to get here comes up, you know, and to see what they say.
And normally in the classroom, are they all just sitting at their desk? No one's really talking to each other.
People aren't talking. They're meant to be quiet. And yeah.
You also read a poem during these hikes. I don't know if that's every time or just sometimes. But is
there? Yeah, it's every time.
Every time. Different poems?
Yes. The couple poets I really like are Wendell Berry and Mary Oliver. Just they have a lot of nature-inspired poems, so I'll pick something that kind of fits the theme or the season. One student said, he said, oh, I see what you did there. You got us eating, and now you're reading the poem. He said that was
They're
smart.
On to you. They're on to you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, what kinds of things are our students getting detention for now these days?
I would say disrespect towards a peer or a teacher or, you know, another faculty member, another staff in the building. So disrespect is one, not being where they're supposed to be. You know, either they've skipped a class or they have repeated tardies to classes. That can land a student with some detentions. Even a student might get detention for 1 hour and they don't serve it, and then it becomes 2 hours, and they don't serve it, and it becomes 3 hours. So that can land them there. And then last year we started using Yonder pouches, and students were not to have their phone during the school day. And there was some consistent traffic with detention from having their phones.
And what about their parents? What have they told you?
Yeah, I think for the most part, the parents have been receptive to the idea. I did have a couple students who enjoyed the hikes a lot, and the parents didn't feel like it was enough of a punishment, so they asked that they not go if they had detention, but that they could still go if they wanted to after school. They could opt in. But parents whose children have gone, they've also expressed that they like the idea and they're supportive of it and appreciative of it.
And what about students who have not, they don't need to be punished, they're doing great? Are they asking you, can we hike too?
Yeah. I just was looking at the math of it, and I did, you know, I've done 21 total detention hikes, and out of 12 of those hikes, I had one or more students opt in just to come along for the hike.
And what about detention rates overall? Have you seen a shift in these after these 21 hikes?
The first hike that I did was a pretty small number, just 2 students. And then last week was just 3 students. And I would say based on last year's number, that's a little bit lower. But I think statistically, it's too soon to say if it's making a big difference.
Is the goal to have fewer students in detention ultimately? What is a measure of success for you?
I have to say, like, one thing that I'm very curious about, because I see a lot of good in the students I'm walking with, and they're young people who are, you know, their frontal lobe is still developing. They are still learning to make good choices for themselves consistently, but I see a lot of good in them, and I, you know, we talk about some of those good things. They're able to talk to me about the fact that they're a volunteer firefighter or that their job is independent lobstering, you know, and so just to hear them and to appreciate what they are doing, that's right. Be an adult who can listen like that. Yeah. I think that the potential for that is also really great. And for example, I had some kids who opted in last week who were pretty consistent detention hikers last year, and they came really to help me out because I needed to make sure that I had enough students to be able to make the hike happen. And they just showed up for me. And then, you know, one of them was a real leader on the hike, and he has a ton of leadership potential. So the, you know, in a small way, I think that that also is helping to build the students, build our community.
Leslie, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for this.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your interest.
Leslie Trundy is a high school counselor in Bath, Maine. Since undergoing two surgeries this year, 15-year-old Dominic Juliet's life has changed drastically. He's also made history. According to Vancouver Coastal Health, the Fort James Secondary School student is one of the first patients in BC and the first Indigenous person in Canada to receive retinal gene therapy to treat a specific form of night vision loss. One of Dominic's doctors, Wai Ching Lam, says it's a complicated procedure, but it should only have to be done once. This morning, Dr. Lam spoke to the CBC, and so did Dominic, whose grandmother and caregiver Linda McGinnis was there too. Here's Dominic talking about his vision before the surgery.
I would constantly need visual aids during school, such as magnifiers and lights. And at home, I would need to keep the lights on pretty much all day, even in rooms where like the sun was glaring through a window, I still wouldn't be able to see in it.
And how different are things for you now after the surgery?
Well, now none of that really applies. Now I can see just fine, especially in dim areas.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, how does that feel?
Pretty good. Very surprising even now. I mean, for the past 15 years, I have not been able to see properly. And now thanks to this surgery, I can. And it's a whole new world for me, even after a few months.
That's great to hear. Now, Dr. Lam, tell us a little more about what it is that causes Dominic's condition.
Yeah, so Dominic has this congenital retinal conditions. It's a congenital night blindness. It only affects about 1 in 50,000 in the population in Canada. So he's born with these problems. It first affect their nighttime visions, and then it gradually also affect their daytime visions, and they will have difficulty seeing, and also they have difficulty adjusting to the light conditions. With age, as they get older, the vision continue to deteriorate, and they can reach the point that they will lose their complete loss of visions at an older age. So it is a like blinding conditions that start off very young.
And finally, Linda, what has changed for you?
Well, I don't have to be his eyes anymore. He can see for himself, navigates around the house in the dark. I took him camping and he got to see the meteor showers and the stars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for the first time. He was always interested when he was little in the solar system, and it was all stuff that he memorized. He didn't actually know what the stars looked like. So that was quite a treat for him after all these years to be able to actually see for himself. And in school, a remarkable difference in school. He navigates around the school by himself. He no longer needs an assistant by his side all day in school. He's pretty much blends in with all the other kids, which is really important for Dominic. He's also in the autism spectrum, so his independence is really important to him, and he's been getting that. It's been a real adventure.
That was Dominic Juliet, his grandmother, Linda McGinnis, who you just heard, and his doctor, Vancouver General Hospital surgeon Wai Ching Lam, talking to CBC host Stephen Quinn this morning on the Early Edition about a first in BC eye surgery for night vision loss.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.